human community, you know, is always a kind of arrangement, you know, arrangement between possible communities, you know. This is why really about politics, I told, you know, no, there is no, politics is not organization of society and power according, you know, to the good rules of the human community. No, politics is always something that comes after, you know. There is a kind of natural, of course it is not natural, but you know, kind of organization of society that looks natural, you know, where the community is organized, you know, under the command of those who have the quality, you know, who are entitled, you know, to do this. And I think politics precisely happens with the disruption of that so-called natural organization of society.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Radical Thoughts podcast. In this episode, we discuss Jacques Rancière's On the Shores of Politics. Right now, you're listening to 22 Ghosts 3 by Nine Inch Nails, but in a second, you'll get to hear us discuss how we should conceive of democracy, questions of populism, the return to Plato and Aristotle, and much more. So, yeah, I wanted to start with this little blurb from the article, Who the Fuck is Jacques Rancière? Because I think it gives a good summary of kind of who he is. He is, quote, a University of Paris professor and former student Louis Althusser. Rancière has committed his intellectual project to destroying the foundations of philosophy. While that may sound a lot like Baudrillard, who wants to remind everyone that everything is a simulation and nothing matters, or Nietzsche, who attacks the foundations of Western metaphysics, Rancière takes a different approach, namely by accusing every other philosopher of being a shitty Platonist and hating democracy. While other philosophers deconstruct the metaphysical tradition and replace it with their own project, Rancière's philosophy can be summed up by, meh, people will figure it out.
Yeah, I feel like I now know who the fuck Rancière is, which is, you know, helpful to start off with. And I do, I guess in the next hour or so, we're going to talk about what the fuck is On the Shore of Politics, which is the Rancière books that we're discussing today.
I haven't read a whole lot of him. I have his more recent book, Aesthesis, which is one of his aesthetic books, because he has a mixture of like a period of mostly political works on democracy and a period of works mostly about aesthetic theory related to politics. But I haven't really delved into much from both of them.
As I mentioned earlier, my first exposure to Rancière was in that title essay from The Emancipated Spectator, which I read when I was doing theatre in undergrad. And at the time, there was this very popular idea that participatory art was much more emancipatory than ordinary art. And Rancière in that essay shows that the need or the requirement for the audience to participate in art to be emancipated is a very patronizing position, because it implies that the audience is this sort of passive subject that needs to be educated or forced into action. And this gives you a kind of idea about how he conceives of the people. The people is not this passive subject that needs to be organized, but it's kind of this entity that emancipates itself or figures itself out in moments of disruption and contention.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were talking a little bit before we started about like the height of politics to him really is kind of like this concept of democracy, but he tries to uphold this idea of democracy as more, I mean, it's very French. It's like democracy is the rupture, the appearance of division that cannot be reconciled. It's not the idea that there's a given, you know, a state that reconciles differences. It's that there is an acknowledged, blatant, like, appearance of injustice through people's actions that is, like, thrown upon kind of like the social political sphere. I mean, when we can probably get into the book a little bit about that to decide to what extent we think he's insightful, to what extent we think that maybe he overextends this.
Yeah, I mean, the book reminds me a bit of the Chantal Mouffe text that we read in the first set, The Return of the Political, because it was published during a specific conjuncture, like the early 90s, when there was a lot of talk about the triumph of liberal democracy over the communist experiment. There was Fukuyama suggesting that liberal democracy represented the end or fulfillment of history. And there are thinkers like Rancière and Mouffe who see this move towards consensus, towards inclusion, as fundamentally unpolitical or post-democratic. And so they're trying to think of models of reintroducing more real politics or more real democracy back into the conversation again, to try and break out of this 1990s impasse.
Yeah, it definitely reminded me of reading the Chantal Mouffe, and I have to say, I kind of, well, the Mouffe piece does have some good engagements with Rawls. I remember liking those parts of it, though I found the kind of descriptions of what they took to be actual political strategy to be kind of meh. I feel like this book does a pretty good job at having some interesting engagements with that really broad historic kind of like proper, you know, political theory, going back to, you know, the questions of what is the demos, what is the republic from ancient Western philosophy. And in a way that made me think, like, it was kind of also a bit of a midpoint to maybe some of the stuff that like Derrida was doing in The Politics of Friendship, though much, much easier to read than that one. So it definitely fits in that kind of milieu. Like, as I said to you when we first started, I was remarking how it does feel like there's a pattern of these kind of 90s books in this set where it's everyone kind of went, well, this communist project didn't work out, it was pretty bad, but now they're talking about liberal democracy. Let's go back and talk about Plato and Aristotle and get to the bottom of what this thing is.
Countless returns. So, I mean, shall we sort of get into some of the ideas that Rancière throws about in this book? Because there is like a very specific lexicon that he uses to introduce and, you know, conceive of his framework towards politics. And we were talking earlier about the third essay, The Community of Equals, which is for Rancière this, it's difficult to determine exactly when Rancière sees a community of equals coming about, because he sees this political entity as something very fleeting and very temporary and very contingent, and something that can't be turned into the basis for a state or a party or organization, but is always in the sort of ebb and flow of the activity of the people.
Mm-hmm. This was, I think, the most kind of juicy piece in this collection. I think it's the longest one. It's a bit hard for me to tell because I'm reading this on a Kindle, so I can't quite tell the lengths and as easily with the others. But I remember thinking this one felt to me like it had the most like in-depth engagement with certain difficult concepts about this idea of what is the role of conceiving a kind of equality for democratic principles, but then also the kind of futility in a sense, but also like, I think it's interesting because he's engaging both with kind of the traditional like liberal egalitarianism that one finds, but he's also trying to talk about this kind of, he has this long bit about the kind of utopian communities built around the idea of a brotherhood of labor. And I think he does a really interesting job at trying to talk about the difficulties of this kind of like equality of labor as a principle for democracy, and why that doesn't necessarily work out as just a principle to hold a community together, particularly because of the way that the acts of labor and the kind of acts of distribution can themselves, well, he kind of talks about it as there will eventually be a split between those who are interested in brotherhood and those that are interested in labor, that will divide a community that seeks to treat them as like synonymous principles of equality.
And one of the points that he makes about these utopian communities that are founded on this theme of the fraternity of labor is that they produce different identities that are key to the principle of the community. So in the example that he uses of the Ikara community that started in the United States, is that this group split humanity into three kinds of people: workers, brothers, and thieves. And workers and brothers will always manage to live together in one family. Thieves, however, have to be thrown out. And the article concludes, the fraternal community is merely applying its own basic principle when it shows layabouts the door. And Rancière shows that this specific community encountered a great deal of difficulties in trying to parse out these different identities of, if you are working in the community and you're distributing the fruits of your labor to other people in the community, are they brothers or are they thieves? If you're only participating in the work, then how can you be a brother when you're primarily functioning as a worker? And then there's the question of the people who are outside of this specific community in the United States, who are back in France sending money to the community in the United States to try and sustain it, of how they relate to the community. So all of these different efforts of establishing a community of equals into a stable form or a principle of organization necessarily produces forms of inequality, because you can never have equality as a principle of society. It can only appear as moments of community within an unequal society, which for Rancière can like radiate out social effects into society, but those effects are, you know, undetermined. You can never really figure out how they're going to change things. You're just going to have to like gather together in these moments of community and hope for the best, it seems. I don't know.
This is the kind of thing that I liked, because as we talked about this a little bit, I've talked about it just as someone who kind of got into communist theory through having been interested in the question of community with these kind of like weirder semi-post-structuralist thinkers. I was like, okay, I get this. This is an interesting question to me. And I think he's doing an admirable job of engaging with that kind of question, because I think that's a very good insight, is that, you know, the divisions of any society in some sense radiate from like the principles of the society itself, right? And he's doing a sort of critique of like the usual assumptions of communists who kind of would erase that will say, no, the principles will just on their own produce the ideal democracy of equals. At the same time, I think that it is a little too easy for him to just go like, it sounds very similar in some ways to some of the liberal critiques of, oh, this will just become totalitarian. You know, you think you can organize something better. Oh, well, you're just going to eradicate kind of like the real difference and struggles of people and try to subsume it or something. It would be one interpretation, I think, that he sometimes skirts a little too close to. Though, because I think to me, the more interesting question is if the principles of democracy are this kind of, or not principles, but if democracy is a kind of a real movement, kind of always will reemerge through the demands of people in the face of injustice or wrongdoing. I think then that becomes a question of like, well, I guess on the one hand, the danger is that you can kind of suggest that real democracy exists, whatever social form you have, in a way. And you get a kind of sense of where he's a French Maoist or an ex-French Maoist in some ways. And then on the other hand, it's like, well, does that provoke a question of like, if you're trying to construct a better society, does that have to do with, in some ways, acknowledging that focal point of democracy? Like, what does it mean to try and engage in recreating society in a better way with that in mind, in a way that can't just be subsumed into like formal legal considerations or something?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like there is no way. Well, not no way out for Rancière, but it is, there is something of a totalitarian impulse for Rancière to think that democracy can never be realized. And so he always falls back on, like the fact that these moments need to be constantly repeated or perpetuated, otherwise, just to prove that, equality does exist between the parties within a society. But what I found difficult when I was reading is how he distinguishes like these moments of the people revolting against the rulers or the government from merely a dialogue between the people and the rulers, because he's very skeptical of attempts by the government to engage in a dialogue with the people, because for him it appears like they're just trying to address the population as a problem and trying to figure out the best way to manage an unruly populace rather than actually engaging with the people as equals.
Which I don't know. I can respect that. I get that. It reads true to me in a sense in terms of, you know, the, what would you call it? Like a means testing democracy or something kind of. Yeah, that kind of like, oh, well, we're going to do this community outreach. We're going to do these focus groups and stuff. That's, yeah, it's not actually about like the political engagement or powers of like people living in activity. It's a fairly paternalizing view.
Yeah. One of the two big Greek terms that Rancière likes is that split between the demos, which, you know, refers to the power of the people, and the oklos, which he sort of defines as the turbulent unification of individual turbulences. And these two ways of conceiving of the people result in two different conceptions of politics. If you conceive of the people as the oklos, as this sort of unruly bunch of people who need to be managed, the goal of politics for you is to try and unify this big unruly group into the one. Whereas what Rancière wants to emphasize is the demos, the belief in the people to split attempts to unify people into one big block and pursue and to demonstrate that there are sort of antagonisms or inequalities within the society. The conception of the people as oklos is linked to Rancière's critique of the end of history as a kind of post-democracy. And post-democratic ideas of government are represented by, you know, the government from government by the experts who see the people as a population who are full of different social problems that can be addressed in very technocratic and top-down ways. Whereas democracy for Rancière is seeing these so-called social problems as fundamental wrongs of social organization that can only be addressed bottom-up in a way.
I think what I have difficulty with to some extent is that not only does he treat these issues as like they're bottom up, but because they come up from the bottom up, they can only be these, you know, they're events with the capital E, right? They're these kind of like moments. I remember that he has that book that's on like worker poets. So like people who are working class and stuff, but who write poetry. Without being these kind of like famous like poets for their livelihood. And he has this bit about the worker who's like carving the wood in a construction site or something, who like looks up out the window, and he has this whole, you know, bit about how that's the moment of poetic freedom that like reinstantiates itself in every moment. And it's very like beautiful. And it has this sense of, you know, like the capacity of any individual actor to affirm a kind of agency, but at the same time he's still just looking up out the window and then going back to work, you know, like. And it reminds me also of some of the passages here about when democracy it announces itself through the appearance of like the mass of actors coming together because of injustice or something. It reminds me of thinking like Blanchot had all this beautiful stuff about May 68, but he kind of keeps romanticizing and emphasizing how what made May 68 so great was the fact that they came together autonomously and then they left autonomously without continuing or making demands. It's like, okay, it romanticizes like the dispersion of the political movement itself as this sign of like its, you know, true power or something.
Yeah, and you get that sense with Rancière that he does celebrate these moments of dissent, of coming together into like a noisy crowd on the street, and then he sort of says, "Oh, but then they disappear, or they dissolve back after this moment," and you feel like there is. I mean, he doesn't seem to be able to think of a way to direct this momentum into something more stable or continuous. It's always going to ebb in the end. And then you wonder what has actually been accomplished from this moment of acknowledging a wrong as a crowd. And to go back to what you were saying about the worker poets, he does have these brief paragraphs where he talks about the democratic actor as a poetic interlocutor of someone who doesn't speak to power in the prescribed forms as trying to establish a dialogue or a compromise, but they're always trying to demand to be heard as equals rather than as a population to be managed. And so I don't know. But because he favors politics as something that's indeterminate and unfinished, you wonder where the momentum of these moments of politics ends up, and whether it doesn't end up just becoming forms of compromise or agreements, as you can see in some of the examples that he draws on in the book, like the agreement between the sort of deal reached between students and the government in French universities in the 90s.
That's the thing. It's like I'm happy to engage in this idea of like the necessity of spontaneous mass action as something that will never be eliminated or subsumed into one ideal kind of society. But I also think it still begs the question of like, is there, you know, better conditions for it to happen under? It almost completely ignores like what the actual demands of, you know, the social reproduction of life itself is, and whether that in that is something that can be done in a much better way. You know, like it's the kind of classic, like, well, sure, this is all very nice to talk about what defines a kind of political principle in the terms of political theory, but it doesn't actually really fully get to the question of like what is I've been reading Soren Mao, so this is also like what is the production of life itself? What are the conditions of living, and are those actually contestable in any sort of way?
Yeah, I mean, he does have these different references to class struggle, especially around page 33, I think, in the second essay, where he is talking about the ability of democratic action to split the perception, split the idea of oneness. He has the sentence on page 33, against the old feudal dream of the great collective body that divided into orders and its new scholarly or vulgar variants, against the new, in quotes, liberal dream of the weights and counterweights of a pluralist society guided by its elites, class struggle proclaimed and placed at the heart of the democratic conflict, the humanizing power of division. And through this moment of class struggle for Rancière, he sees it as undoing these perceived links of the organic political body, like the nation or the state or the fiefdom, and to expose the real division that exists with in a society, especially a society rift with class antagonisms. But I mean, he doesn't tolerate the traditional juxtaposition between formal democracy and real democracy. Like the difference that's usually stated is that bourgeois states have a purely formal democracy where there are, you know, rights to vote and, you know, rights to work, but also rights to starve. And then a real democracy would be much more substantive and make sure that democratic activity and participation pervades the entirety of society. Whereas Rancière refuses that juxtaposition and says, well, the point is to really emphasize on the principle of real equality in the moment. And if equality does not exist, say, in the struggle between workers and their boss, what the workers should do is not just lament the gulf between formal and real democracy, but to say that the boss is not living up to the law that's embodied in the French in the democratic state. So either the law needs to change or the boss needs to recognize us as equals. And so he sees class struggle as less about, the production of the means of production of life, and more about recognition of democratic principles, even if those ideas of equality and liberty can never be fully, you know, completed or embodied within those principles.
I did like his bit on like in the Greek model, he has that bit about how actually, because the like Platonic idea rejects, you know, self-mastery or self-discipline, there's no like community of equals proper. There's the community of masters. So like the equality that exists is the equality to have individualized property, not to have, you know, equal rights over a common property or social property. And also like the community. He also has the community of monks that are all slaves to one another through their obedience.
And I think he points out the disjuncture between community and society in that commentary on Plato's Republic, where he shows, okay, Plato did solve the problem of the community of equals by forming this, or proposing this idea of a community of gardens. No, not gardens, a community of guardians within the Republic. But they could only have that equality because they were located within an imagined, well, in a real society of like of slave labor, and so within the wider society. So you can only have a community of equals within unequal society within the Platonic ideal, and this is why he goes on to critique the monks and also the utopian communists. In Icarus that we discussed earlier, because they, I guess, refused to acknowledge like Plato's solution, I guess, in the Republic, of that to have a stable community of equals, you must have an unequal. It must be located within an unequal society. And that for the Rancière, his anti-Platonist solution is to render the community of equals as something much more fleeting and temporary that still may have social effects within the wider sphere, the wider social sphere or something. I don't know. I mean, as we keep on coming back to it, it's just like I do appreciate these moments, this sort of celebration of more like spontaneous and more indeterminate moments of disruption and contention. It's just trying to pin down what the social effects are is what's difficult, which is maybe just more of a, which is maybe just a Platonic impulse that Rancière would reject as something totalitarian. But also what's very interesting about his conception of the community of equals is that it is something that can really occur anywhere. There isn't a predetermined space for politics to take place. It can happen wherever people gather to either bring attention to a political wrong or demand to be heard or seen as equals, or try to point out their own mistreatment in a way that doesn't present them, in a way that they don't present themselves as victims, but rather as people to be taken as equals.
That is part of what I do enjoy, is that the premise of recognition, so-called, is more on the grounds of the kind of like the human agency to disrupt things, like, is what ultimately foregrounds the politics of democracy and recognition. Though I think it's also, it would be kind of interesting, I guess, to compare the way he talks about recognition to the like Lacalou and Mouffe kind of recognition, and then maybe look at some of the critiques of certain kinds of recognition politics that are advanced by someone like Coulthard. I can't remember his first name.
Oh, Glenn Coulthard, right? Red skin, white masks.
Yeah. Which is obviously a nod towards Fanon's own variations on the question of recognition politically. It would be interesting to kind of look at that, because on the one hand, I don't think that someone like Coulthard or Fanon are explicitly saying that there's no, their critique, I don't think, is necessarily that there's no need for recognition among human beings, but they're foregrounding how a lot of times even this attempt at a radical claim to a politics of recognition ultimately rests on eventually the state has to make some sort of mandate or principle of okay, we are legally sending down things that recognize you, which then ultimately puts the ball back in the hands of the state to, keep producing these efforts at recognition, which ultimately mean, you know, oh, but the state is recognizing you, so you have to acquiesce to these certain principles and the grounds that, you know, you're being recognized and stuff like that. Like, I think it would be kind of interesting to look at that, because Rancière is clearly, I think, more, I mean, he's more interesting to me than a lot of that kind of Laclau and Mouffe and that kind of politics of recognition to some extent. But I do wonder if maybe it still gets into the same kind of impasse.
Yeah, I don't know whether Rancière is particularly a thinker of recognition and identity in the same way as Laclau and Mouffe. For him, our different identity categories are an obstacle to being treated as the equals that we already are. And so for Rancière to be, you know, to engage in democracy at all is to break apart the categories that are assigned to us as either, you know, a worker or a student or even a citizen, just to push towards this moment of real equality, which is an exceptional moment. It's not the ordinary operating, you know, system of democracy. I don't know if that computer metaphor works, but it's what ended up coming out. And he's also skeptical about attempts to study society that proceed from the premise of looking for inequality. So he has this critique of sociological studies of inequality in society. And he almost says that if you're going to just look at society and find inequality, then you're sort of stuck in just sort of saying that society is always going to be unequal, or resorting to state activities to try and treat the unequal party in these formations as a social problem that need to be addressed. And the end point of all of these different kinds of studies is what he writes on 52 is can only succeed in setting up a hierarchy of inequalities, a hierarchy of priorities that will reproduce inequality ad infinitum. And so there are, for him, he's very, you know, critical of attempts to set up, you know, I guess, you know, hierarchies of inequality or oppression that can then just be transferred over to certain state bodies to, you know, cure through different social measures like, handing out money to treat social ills. And for Rancière, you always need to start off from the acknowledgement that we are always already equal, and it's a moment of, and politics is trying to get that, trying to bring back that equality into moments of emancipatory action.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, but I think that's a difficulty, is that it's about moments. And I think it's interesting how little he seems to me to even really engage with, like, he talks about these moments of struggle that involve, you know, confrontation with the state in its political, like, instantiation, the state of affairs as such, but he doesn't really actually go into any detail of a theory of, like, what the state is, or, like, what the construction of political action through the state is. Like, it all just seems kind of taken for granted that this is just going to be what it is, but we can always have these confrontations that establish, like, the real equality in the moment. I don't know. I don't find it particularly satisfying as a way to, like, really question the establishment of, like, 90s, like, neoliberal politics.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that for Rancière, whatever kind of state there is, it will always function to suppress politics, try to unify different factions of the people into a homogenous population and try to prevent, you know, democracy from taking place as these moments of emancipation. But apart from that, there is no clear sense of how certain ideologies operate within different kinds of states, how the state's relationship to economies and the rest of society. For Rancière, the state is just this this false embodiment of democracy that must always be resisted, and I think that that's failure of distinction between different types of states is probably one of the weaknesses in the book, but also one of the signs of the times in which it was published. I think that there was probably a mood in which, you know, states were felt to be like all the same or totally bad, and that the failure of communism in the 20th century was that it tried to take forms in worker states rather than pursue different kinds of democracy.
This is a book that I've enjoyed more than some of the other ones we've read of this milieu and time frame, but it's also just very, very marked by that time frame and the kind of assumptions of like what is possible or what constitutes the grounds for these kind of debates. I don't know. I think that there are maybe some more preferable kind of political questions to be advancing at this point. I'm not someone who's like really excited about reading an exit like excursus on the Republic again to like try and argue about the contemporary situation.
I wonder why that happened. Why there are so many returns to Plato and Aristotle in European sort of radical political theory in the 90s. Maybe it was just a response to failure, or the response to the proclamation of the end of history that drove it. But I'd be interested to read something about why there was this, why several thinkers did see the need to return to classic political thought, and whether it was part of like a larger debate between different thinkers. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think part of it definitely seems to be in relation to, yeah, like the whole, how much of the end of history argument and the relationship with that and people like Rawls and stuff, just the general question of like trying to get back to the roots of this discussion about what constitutes democracy and republicanism, I think is probably part of it. But I don't know enough about like many of the other kind of side of this, many of the liberal arguments from Fukuyama, et cetera, were like properly engaging with, you know, like the classical antiquity tradition to give justice to their claims, you know?
Yeah, I feel like Fukuyama was more like engaged with Hegel, obviously.
Yeah.
Hobbes. And I think that there is some references to classical thought in his discussion of anger, but also that's based largely on Nietzsche. At the end of history and the last man, to give it the full title, the end of history is from Hegel and the last man is from Nietzsche, which is a heady blend. But I don't know how much of it was based on classical.
I mean, Derrida does his engagement with Aristotle and the like kind of through a detour with Schmitt. So I don't know if that's also kind of, and that's someone who also influences Laclau and Mouffe, I think, to some extent too. But yeah, I don't really know. It would be interesting to try and kind of do an investigation of like, why was this discussion of antiquity philosophy like such a in vogue part of this kind of 90s return to theory I think that the third essay in this book is the most interesting one to read. If anyone wants to check it out, I would personally probably just recommend reading that one more than I would recommend like the whole book. That said, it's very short. It's one of the shortest we've read.
Short and sweet. And I think that it would be paired nicely with his book on The Ignorant Schoolmaster, which is his contribution to pedagogy, where he's basically like, okay, we just need to trust the students to learn for themselves rather than treat them like idiots. And there are links between that and moments in this book where he's also saying maybe we shouldn't treat the people as a social problem to be managed within a liberal democracy, but rather trust them to come up with their own fight for emancipation and to show that they are already equal, despite the circumstances of their social inequality. But yeah, I feel like going out in the streets and, you know, burning some buildings. It's like that Bordeaux quote, we need a social movement that burns cars, but with a purpose.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I was excited that he did have a small critical engagement with Bourdieu, but I actually didn't really get what he was getting at for part of it. And
yeah, but I feel like his engagement with Bourdieu is just another instance of like him calling everyone else a dirty Platonist. There's one of his other books where he savages Bourdieu. I think it's The Intellectual and His People, where he has a bunch of critiques about how different philosophers are wrong when it comes to talking about the people.
Yeah, it seems I kind of got the feeling that he was going like, oh, Bourdieu has this critique of how schools and stuff aren't actually democratic because they in fact reproduce like inequalities and, you know, elite, you know, access to elite spheres and stuff. But then he just goes like, but that means he kind of just seems to go like Bourdieu then ends up dismissing democracy or only handing it over to political like platformism, and that's bad. That's kind of what I thought I got the feeling was.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's interesting stuff here, but it's kind of its time.
Well, speaking of another interesting book that's probably of its time, shall we read the Zizek book on woman?
Isn't it the Schelling one?
Yeah, the Schelling one. Oh, I always get confused. Yeah, I think it's the one on Schelling and woman.
On Schelling and related matters.
Oh, okay, I guess I must be mistaking it for one of his other books. Oh, no, the
Well, oh yeah, we already did that.
Well, thank goodness we got that under the belt. So we're just gonna hit the related matters next time.
We've already read Zizek on how women be. So
yeah. Well, there we go. We're gonna be talking about Groundhog Day and Forrest Gump, plus Schelling.
I'm curious about this one because we actually haven't read a whole lot that gets into the whole like, okay, we got to talk about Hegel and German idealism and everything. Like, it showed up a little bit in the psychoanalysis stuff we've read in the first set, but I don't know, I'll be curious to see what he has to say about Schelling, since Schelling is not usually the most well-known German idealist that gets talked about. So I'm curious about it.
Well, yeah, hopefully we'll have a Schelling February.
That's it for this episode. Thank you for listening. If you want to support the podcast, you can go to our Patreon and subscribe for $3 a month. A Patreon subscription gets you access to all our bonus episodes. We have an exciting one coming up this month, an interview with Seth Wheeler where we talk about the book In and Against the State, bank robberies, the students' movement in the UK, and much more. Next month we're reading The Indivisible Remainder on Schelling and Related Matters by Slavoj Žižek.
Get a copy if you want to read with us. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.